Support for the Media Project comes from the College of St. Rose, Albany, New York, offering a Master of Arts in Communications to advance careers in media, PR, and journalism. Fuller part-time options, 518-454-5143. And Rosenbaum Media Group, a digital communications agency integrating high-definition video into PR, marketing, advertising, and social media campaigns. Big-picture thinking for local and national clients. RosenbaumMedia.com. From Northeast Public Radio, this is The Media Project, a weekly discussion about issues confronting the media.
Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. They know the lowdown, now it can be told. I'll tell you quite reliably off the record about some charming people I have known.
I learned that song 54 years ago from the man who wrote it, Vern Partlow, who was at that time, I guess, maybe 30 years old and a working newspaperman in Los Angeles, a man who liked to write songs and the strum of guitar, an extraordinary man, really. He wrote a song for a friend of his who died after spending a lifetime as a rewrite man, never getting his own byline, always rewriting somebody else's stuff.
That's the inimitable Pete Seeger, the one and only, of course, who sings the theme song of this program and who we've lost in the last few days. Welcome to The Media Project. I'm Rex Smith, editor of The Times Union, here with Rosemary Armeo, investigative journalist and professor at UAlbany, and Dr. Alan Shartok, CEO of Northeast Public Radio and a friend of Pete.
Yep, I remember when he told me that story, and we recorded it, and there it is.
It's fabulous. You know, when I go around to places in public, people will come up to me and start singing that song.
Sure.
It's really funny. It's a wonderful song, of course.
Some people think it's the best part of the program.
Well, yes, I've heard that. It is actually part of the magic of Pete Seeger is that so many people can identify with his music and get a special lift out of something. And for people who aren't even engaged in journalism, that song sort of captures some of the magic of it,
mm-hmm.
some of the wonder of, you know, we meet such interesting people.
Well, you know, he was a magic man, and after he died, he was extolled by so many people. There were so many columns and newspapers and individuals who wrote on him. But what I found fascinating is that the New York Post, which can't stop itself, took a real shot at him editorially, you know, on the way out.
Really?
Yes, it was really, you know, the references to Stalin and to communism
days.
And
mm-hmm.
all the rest. It was so déclassé of them to do. And, you know, just shows their extremism knows no bounds.
Well, you
the
know,
post,
since the Post under... Yes, Post.
I'm shocked.
You know, since it in its current ultra-right wing incarnation, it would be embarrassing to the Post for us to bring back what it was doing 60 years ago, you know, 70 years ago,
right.
Which was when Pete was engaged in real strong support of communism. So let's see what the Post's editorials might look like. They'd be horrified, wouldn't they, if we held the Post to account for their actions of the 1940s?
Yeah, and in those days when Pete was pro-Soviet Union, which I certainly never was, it's interesting that so was some other Americans like Franklin Delano Roosevelt and others without whom that Second World War could not have been won.
Mm-hmm. So the Media Project is our annual, our annual.
It
is our,
seems like
once a year we get together. And, yeah.
Well, you know, that's what they say about the Texas State Legislature, which meets every other year for 60 days. Yeah. And the saying in Texas is it'd be better if they'd meet every 60 years for every other day or something. Anyway, we have a letter from, in the context of something that we talked about last week. We talked about the article in Grantland, which is the ESPN website about the magic putter that revealed that the inventor of the magic putter, so-called Dr. V, was in fact a transsexual. Mm-hmm. And Germaine writes to us and says, the concern is they apologized for an irresponsible act of journalism and passed it off as slipping through the cracks and not conforming with the, and not conferring with the transgender person before print, because Dr. V did in fact commit suicide during the reporting of the story. They have chosen to leave the page up as an example of poor journalism. Are they using this page as clickbait? Mm-hmm. And are they continually making money on this unfortunate event? I feel like they have no remorse for their actions, and they are going to fly this in the face of everyone regardless. If you wrongly or in bad taste show the identifiable bodies of a plane crash or disaster and said, oh, we were wrong to do this, but we're going to leave the pictures on our page as an example of poor journalism, you wouldn't do that. That don't sit well with me, says Germaine. So,
And the newspaper, again?
Grantland. It is a website of ESPN. Oh, was that because ESPN is 20% owned by my company, Hearst Corporation? Is
actually,
that why
not at all. We are all properly paranoid, but frankly, it went by me, and I didn't hear it. So that's great.
But thank you for revealing it.
Yeah. it's a wonderful thing. When cash rolls in from one thing. However, yes, that is probably an appropriate thing to do. Speaking of apologies,
good one.
United States Representative Michael Grimm. If folks missed this, in the aftermath of the State of the Union speech, Congressman Grimm is being interviewed by a reporter for New York One, the Time Warner cable operation in New York City. And the reporter apparently tries to go on with the questioning.
Yeah, he asked him about his reaction to the State of the Union, which was extremely mundane, probably not usable. He goes, well, I want to ask you about your campaign financing. He's been in some legal trouble. He's under investigation for some improprieties. And he storms off. But then, most amazingly, he comes back, gets into this as a very mild-mannered reporter, like defines
You're
this
quite.
Guy. Exactly. Michael Scotto, I think is his name. He's like 35 years old. And he gets right in the guy's face. He goes, if you ever do that to me. And then he's making
the camera's rolling all the while.
The camera is rolling all the time. Now, he did kind of whisper a little bit. Some of it's inaudible, and his back is to the camera. But it's all there. Hey, I'm going to throw you over the balcony. You're not man enough to take me on. Oh,
and
my God.
And there were some expletives.
He says, let me be 30. If you ever do that again, I'll throw you off the effing balcony. Yeah. And then when Scotto says, well, it's a valid question, and you can hear him saying, it's valid, isn't it?
Yeah.
He says, you're not man enough. I will break you in half like a boy.
What a
and
jerk.
And the congressman storms off.
And, the reporter, with that kind of provocation, I could easily have devolved into something much worse. The reporter was actually completely professional in the whole thing. Of course, then the next day, he's on every talk show everywhere talking about it, making hay off of it, which I can't blame him.
I don't know if he was making the hay or whether the people who were inviting him on were making the hay.
Well, that's true. That's a good point. Grimm's initial response after this and after he's getting, huge criticism from everyone for his indefensible behavior, put out a statement just saying, I expect a certain degree of professionalism from reporters. Yeah, so I told him off. It's not the first time. It won't be the last. He was just so flippant about it.
Yeah, right. Absolutely. And then finally apologizes. Apparently his political advisors got to him. He apologizes and says, well, I invited him out to lunch. If that reporter goes to lunch with
the congressman. No, he already said he would.
He said he was going to.
Well, he better take a camera with him. And the first thing he better do is ask the question again, because his responsibility is to get an answer from the question. And if the congressman is refusing to answer, hold him to account. Don't sit down and eat with the man if he's not going to answer the question.
Well, Rex, it's a great story because the question was about his campaign finance and the fact that his associate got into real trouble.
Associate being his girlfriend.
His girlfriend was raising money. Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Yep.
Okay.
Yep.
And charged. Okay. So something that almost nobody really knew about. Now everybody in the world knows about
it
because of his stupid actions.
Idiot.
Well, there's a complaint against him in Congress. Boehner's office is calling him saying, this is uncalled for. So he had to apologize.
Yeah.
He was under.
Well, but then listen in the way that he apologizes. And, we get accustomed to this kind of thing. He then says that his mother will probably give him an earful and says the outburst was right. Yeah. Oh, give me a break. The congressman is, 50 some years old.
Yeah.
And now he's saying, my mom is going to get on me about it. So this is just a ridiculous ploy.
Well, there's some PR people who are sitting around a room trying to figure out how to play it.
Talk about your mom.
This is not, I think, the sort of rebranding that the Republican Party wanted or needed.
But let me ask you guys a question. I mean, call me naive, but he did apologize.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So are we never going to accept apologies on face value? That one can mess up and then apologize?
Nope. You don't take anything on face value in this business. I think there is, especially when you're dealing with somebody who stands for election, and I think that everything has an ulterior motive. I'm sorry, but I don't believe, I think that the real guy was speaking when he said, I will break you, throw you off this balcony, and the apology, grudging apology, was just because he felt
after
that he
his first
it.
Flippant remark.
Right.
A couple of things. As we speak, this yet another explanation of what was going on from him in which he said, I was very tired.
Yeah.
Okay, and number two, Rex.
I always threaten people when I'm tired.
Number two, Rex and Rosemary, I hate to say this, but I agree with you.
Amazing. Well, by the way, the other day, there were more intemperate remarks made by the leader of CSEA, the largest union of New York State employees,
goodness, yes.
Danny Donahue, who got up in front of a crowd at the state capitol and called Governor Andrew Cuomo a monkey and a moron.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, this was actually not initially presented to me when our reporter put forth this story. It wasn't touted by the editor putting it forward as a very significant story, but because it was just it wasn't a huge demonstration. There were no legislators in town, really. But, you know, when a union leader says that about the governor, it seems to me it's a big deal. So actually, I stripped it across the top
today.
Of the front
yeah,
page.
Yeah.
It seems to me that that is something
it.
That will, the journalistic issue is what makes something like that newsworthy. The political issue is, I think he's going to have hell to pay for it, by the way.
Well, let me tell you, civil servants in New York State are not in a good mood right now. And if you want to maintain your leadership, I'm a big Danny Donahue fan and always have been.
Good, because he's good copy? Because he's good for us as journalists?
No, I like him. I've interviewed him any number of times. I think he's a very decent guy. But and he fights hard for his people. And I know his people are very frustrated. So it may well be that what was going on here is he had a decision to make. Am I going to really get out in front of this and say something that might appear to such honorable people as Rex Smith as intemperate, but will be just what my people want me to say.
I think we have far too much intemperate talk in politics and public life, and for union leaders and for congressmen to behave like this is not a good thing, and it should be criticized in the press. I'm very happy the reporter behaved properly. Remember Carl Paladino who
yes.
blew up at a reporter? That was, mm-hmm. I mean, right there. That was reason enough not to vote for him right there. That is not how you conduct public life.
I see.
Yeah.
Well, I've given what I consider to be the rationale for why a union leader gets angry at a governor,
mm-hmm.
especially a governor who has, well, monkeyed around with his members and been
said monkeyed around with my members, that would have been different than saying he is a monkey. I read the direct quote. That's
No.
It's the biggest monkey we have.
Everything would have been different. Everything could be different.
Part of being a grown-up and a professional is you temper your anger. So he's right to be angry. He's right to represent his people. But you don't do that well when you get up and call the governor names.
Well,
he probably hurt them.
Well, Rosemary, why would I get into this, you know, over my head? But why do you think he didn't know what he was doing? My position is he did know what he was doing. He knew, I mean, I'm not saying it was right. I'm just saying he knew what he was doing. As Rex said quite correctly before, there's always an ulterior motive. And his ulterior motive in this case was to keep his people with him and mm-hmm. to win the next election.
Well, you've given speeches, both of you guys have given speeches, and sometimes when you have a receptive audience and you get going, you do get carried away. You say things that you would never write down. And I'm not sure that he did plan it ahead of time. I think his rhetoric carried him away. I think he was just angry.
It's interesting sometimes in journalism, we often will pick up a quote, we'll have something that somebody says, and it will become really newsworthy and really hot. I'm thinking, for example, of what Governor Cuomo said recently that got him in a lot of hot water when he talked about Republicans not being welcome. The ultra-right wing, there's no room for them in New York State.
No room for them, right.
You know, it seems to me that got a lot of attention beyond its merit because that's kind of a gotcha quote. That is not something that is a significant statement of opinion as much as it seems to me it is almost a slip of the tongue.
And what was the ulterior motive there, Rexy?
What was the ulterior motive?
Yeah. See, to me, the ulterior motive is that here is the governor involved in a huge fight with the new mayor of New York, Bill de Blasio, no matter what they say. One guy is a progressive, wants to tax the rich. The other guy wants to lower taxes. And Cuomo's got a problem with his left flank. Because his left flank believes what de Blasio believes.
Uh-huh.
You know, tax everybody. So I'm just giving you a potential reason that he said it. So he comes out and he says, conservatives or that kind of whatever the exact quote was, aren't welcome in New York State. The left wing says, attaboy, Andy. Way to go.
Well, that's interesting. It's possible. I guess it's different from taking something out of context. You know, we have an example of that here. Bloomberg News last week pulled a quote from the CEO of Bayer about a drug that they were developing.
Mm-hmm.
And as quoted by Bloomberg News, here's what it said. We did not develop this medicine for Indians, that is in India.
Yeah.
We developed it for Western patients who can't afford it. Well, of course, you hear that kind of thing. That sounds racist, doesn't it?
Yes, evil.
Yes, it does.
I once had an old doctor, long gone, who said to me, I said, what about this medicine for me? And he said, no, first for the animals, then for the Europeans, and then for you.
That's along the same lines.
This thinking has been around for a long time.
However, the fact of the matter is, and that's what he said that on December 3rd. It went viral after Bloomberg published it almost a month later. But what he actually said, this is at a conference sponsored by the Financial Times. He was being asked about this drug that was being developed. He said, is it going to have a big effect on our business model? No, because we did not develop this product for the Indian market. Let's be honest. We developed this product for Western patients who can afford this product, quite honestly. It is an expensive product, being an oncology product. So, you know, in context, the quote, A, it was not quite rendered the way Bloomberg shortened it a little bit and rendered it. But in context, you understand he wasn't saying, we're not going to sell this to Indians. He was saying this isn't part of our business.
Probably should say that the article Bloomberg was writing was actually about bypassing patents. Indians bypass patents in order to get expensive drugs into their country. Yeah. That's what they were writing about. And then you've got the head of Bayer saying, oh, we didn't develop it for those guys. When, in fact, his quote actually had to do with a specific question about the effect of this drug on a business model. Now they're using it in India without really paying for it. Is that going to hurt you? What's the effect? So you can see, he goes, no, no, you know, it's really kind of irrelevant. It's not maybe good. It may be the same attitude as your doctor, but it certainly is not that evil, racist quote that it comes out. And it went viral after that.
So you blame Bloomberg.
Bloomberg did not do a good job.
Bloomberg News, not the mayor.
Former.
Yes, right, absolutely.
Although there is a connection.
Well, there could well be. You know, I remember when I first became a young reporter at Newsday on Long Island, quickly learning from editors there who would handle my stories. And, you know, if you're a smart young reporter, you watch what somebody does and they edit your story, you learn a lot really fast. And I learned to punch up a story. And that was to take my boring piece that I had written and to shape it just a little bit to make it interesting, to give it power.
Punch, they used to call it.
Yeah, absolutely, to give it punch. And often it is removing words. Less is often more. And it was a really great lesson, but you have to be really careful when you punch up a story that you still keep it accurate, that you don't overstate, that you don't, by removing stuff, remove so much context that you take away the truth of it.
Sure.
If you're just joining us, this is the Media Project from Northeast Public Radio. Alan Shartok, the CEO of Northeast Public Radio, is over here. And Rosemary Armeo, investigative journalist and professor at UAlbany in the middle. And I'm Rex Smith, editor of the Times Union over at the far microphone. You can't see us, but you know we're describing it for folks.
I thought you meant in the middle, like between the two of
us. Yes. Well, you're not such a good middle player, Rosemary.
No,
you're,
I'm not.
You're one.
One never knows where Rosemary is going.
Absolutely. So out in Colorado, where all kinds of weird things are happening, what do you think about the fact that the Super Bowl is played between the teams from the two states that have legalized recreational use of marijuana?
I think that says something.
Reefer Bowl? Not sure what it says, but there we go. Anyway, out in Colorado, in other news, a Colorado Senate committee has come back on this issue that we've talked about on this show before, and that is the Fox News reporter Jana Winter. A New York court, remember the New York's Court of Appeals, the highest court, ruled that she did not have to testify in the trial of the guy who did the shooting in the theater out in
Aurora.
Thank you. Right. James Holmes is his name. Because the Court of Appeals ruled that she is covered, protected by the Shield Law in New York State.
So now the legislature in Colorado takes up the issue of, hey, maybe we better have a law like New York's. That's a pretty good law. It protected her. Maybe we should help our reporters. But the results.
A Colorado Senate committee has rejected the proposed changes to the Shield Law. He would have set a higher bar for courts to subpoena journalists. And instead of saying, yes, we need to protect journalists, the legislature said, no, we're kind of happy with the way it is.
Yeah, you know, there's a natural antipathy when you think about it between politicians. We've been talking about it all day, between politicians and the press.
It's true. That is a theme of this, isn't it?
And there's the possibility that, you know, the lawmakers will do anything to punish the press, which is always, they think, punishing them. They're calling them, they're asking them embarrassing questions, they're putting them up against the wall, they want to know about donors, they want to know about girlfriends, you name it, they want to know. And if you're a politician, everybody, put yourself in their place, how would you feel about these reporters? You wouldn't like them.
Yeah.
They make different noises when asked conceptually, do you respect the press? Oh, yes, you respect the First Amendment. Oh, yes, you know. But in the end, I've worked with a lot of politicians, so have you, Rex, and we know these guys are, the press are regarded as the enemy.
It is a difficult situation, too, because as the media get less respect from the public, you know, we've seen all the polls showing that in the broad sense, when people are asked, do you respect reporters, the respect has been going down and down. And as that happens, there is less of a chance that there will be consequence on the part of the legislators who attack or seek to limit the independence of the press.
You know, I think the press does a really bad job defending itself. Even the name of this legislation, Shield legislation, like we're some knights that have this big shield and we have to be protected. So when the legislators say, well, we weigh the interest of a free press against the interest of the court getting information to do its job, that sounds a lot better than us saying, oh, no, we should be protected. Instead, what we should be saying is that when you go after a reporter in a court to get information, you are being really lazy. In the case of Jana Winters, they were going after her because they did not want to force police to say which one of you talked to the reporter. So the shield laws that, and strong shield laws, New York has one, the courts are not hurt. The laws are set up so that the courts get the information they need and reporters are not shielded in those very rare and few instances when they have vital information and there's no other way to get it. We don't explain that well enough.
That's right. That's exactly right. People don't understand that there are plenty of avenues for getting information before you need to go and haul a reporter into court and try to get them to break what a court has held is a contract of confidentiality. When you promise confidentiality to someone, that is actually a contract between your news organization and that individual. And before you start breaking contracts by order of a court, there should be legal consequences.
Well, let's explore that a little bit. You know, they can make a contract with anybody that they want, the reporter, and say, okay, this is off the record or this is confidential and I won't use your name. But they're not the legislature. They're not a lawyer. And as far as what Rosemary just said before she jumps down my throat here.
I'm going to throw you off a balcony.
Break you like a boy.
You know, there are times you just assume they're being lazy. But there are times a reporter comes forward and gives information that the prosecuting authorities just don't have.
Not good reporters. You would not recommend a reporter would do that.
No.
We don't work for prosecutors. That is not the job of
Indeed,
a reporter.
Indeed, you don't.
As I say, the law does not say, oh, reporters are different, special. They're the only Americans who don't have to testify. What they say is, because of the job you have protected by the U.S. Constitution, which most jobs are not, you only have to testify in that rare circumstance where we can't get the information elsewhere, and it's really important.
Well, but
and then you go in and you testify or you go to jail. Many reporters have gone to jail.
And you're the one, Rosemary, who's deciding when it is one of those rare occasions.
No, the court is deciding it.
Yes, but I'm saying to you that I can't imagine you in any of these cases saying, as in this case, which we're discussing now, I can't imagine you saying...
I would never give up my source. You're right. Yeah. If the court had ruled against Jana Winter, they had called her in, and she has said this too. It's not like I'm some noble person.
Mm-hmm.
She said, I would go to jail. And that is the right of all U.S. citizens. You either obey the law or you take the consequences. She was willing to take the consequences. Other mm-hmm. reporters have taken the consequences and gone to jail.
I've had my say.
Thank you,
Adam. We have a... actually, I was just talking to our wonderful reporter, Brendan Lyons, our investigations editor, who was recalling when our counsel here in Albany was trying to keep him from having to testify in a case where a drug dealer had basically said to him, yeah, basically, we got a drug enterprise going on here. And that word enterprise is pretty key to the kind
sure
of... because that is actually the word in the statute under which he was being prosecuted. And the reporter said, they can see it in my news story, but I'm not going to go on the stand and talk about the other things that he might have said to me that I didn't put in the story. And the lawyer said, Brendan, I think you better bring your toothbrush, because he thought that the judge was going to hold him in contempt if he didn't testify. In fact, the federal judge here in Albany who was hearing the case, this is now 10 years ago, decided that he wasn't going to make him testify, that the prosecutors could go on, and the prosecutors did get the conviction without the testimony of the reporter. You know, we even have a difficult situation in civil testimony. We have a reporter who wrote a story about this interesting case last year in the New York courts in which a strip club was being brought in to question by the taxing authorities of New York State. If it's purely entertainment, they need to pay tax. If it's art,
yes.
Exotic dancing,
yes.
They don't have to pay the tax.
Steve Barnes,
our wonderful reporter went on the Colbert program and did this funny riff. His conclusion was, how can you differentiate their dancing from the New York City Ballet up the road? They're dancing. It's art. It's a really interesting case. And there's now civil litigation still ongoing about this. And I don't want Steve to testify testify on that. They would love to have him testify and go on the witness stand as an expert witness. And I just think that once you break down that wall and say, oh, it's okay for reporters to testify, you can go that. I think it's too dangerous.
You make a good point. And of course, you know, when Steve testifies, if he does testify, I hope they have a very good stenographer who can take it all down.
Yes, the Colbert people should be there.
With that, we hope to see you next week on The Media Project. And let's bring back Pete for some more.
Press, extra, extra, read all about it. It's a mess, meets the test. Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. It's wonderful to represent the press.